happen. Now the boat won't float, I don't like it. I'm too proud to be poor. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. We're not a working. We're not a working. We're just not working anymore. They used to call us working class, but we're just
hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you on air by listener-supported community radio station WEFT at 90.1 FM and webcasting live worldwide at WEFT.org. Views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Gus with some underwriting announcements.
This hour program is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. This hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice, both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Gus. Well, we got an interesting program today. We have Mark Dudzik, the national organizer for the Labor Campaign for Single Payer, calling in from Washington, D.C. at 11:30. And right now, we have a very special guest in the studio, Bill.
Yeah, I was going to say, was Dudzik involved with the Labor Party?
Yeah, I believe he was, because he's out of the oil, chemical workers.
Yeah, I think that's probably where I first heard of him, too.
Yeah, okay. But anyway, we got a very special guest here in the studio. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Ron Stanley. I'm the business rep with the International Association of Machinists, and I represent some workers who are locked out at Clifford Jacobs presently.
Okay, I guess just for those listeners who aren't quite or haven't heard about the what happened, you just want to give a quick a synopsis of what's been happening here in the last week or so.
Sure. Clifford Jacobs is a forging company here in Champaign. We've got 70 union employees there, made up of three different unions. We've got the Boilermakers, which has about 50 members there. The Machinist has about 19, and IBEW has one. We're all under the same contract, and have been in negotiations for the last month. The weekend of the, right before the 29th, negotiations broke down. We finally got a contract, last best and final offer from the company. We voted that on Monday the 28th, and our members, unanimously voted that down and gave us strike authorization. At that time, we went in. On the 29th, we went to send them into work, and the company locked us out at that point.
Okay. And I understand that there was another plant up in Ontario that was also locked out a couple days later?
They were not locked out, but they went on strike.
Okay.
IMT, who is the parent company who owns Clifford Jacobs, is out of Canada. They have three shops, PC, Forge, Welland Forge, and Clifford Jacobs. Welland Forge, after we were locked out, they were in negotiations. Also, they decided to vote down their contract and are out on strike also.
Okay. Okay, so I know, of course, you know, with any kind of, you know, ongoing negotiations, there's some things that, you know, you really don't want to make public, but, can you let the listeners know a little bit about maybe what some of the, sticky point issues are? I mean, just in general?
In general, I mean, wages, they proposed a 4-year, freeze on wages, and I don't want to get too much into it.
Sure.
Insurance was also an issue. They wanted to cut their contribution, and to be honest, the way it would have worked out, it would have been cheaper for the employees, but they would be taking on a lot of risk on the method that they were proposing.
Okay, all right. So what's been happening now since the lockout Tuesday morning? Was that October 1st? Oh, no, I'm sorry, that was 29th?
The 29th.
Okay.
Yeah. We've set up an informational picket outside the plant, and we've been there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week since then.
Okay. All right. And so, you know, I was out there a couple times, and last Sunday there was actually a rally from, you know, people from the community that came out, and I thought it was pretty well attended. Has this helped the spirit of the workers there?
It has greatly. And that's one thing I would like to do is thank the community for their support. And from the local labor organizations, people are stopping by daily, dropping off food, water, drinks, just showing them support. We've had politicians stop by.
Oh, really? Which ones?
We had Scott Bennett stop by.
Okay. All right.
I just want to say, too, and this place is really out of the way. I mean, it's like on the farthest corner of the most isolated neighborhoods.
Right by the CN Railroad Yard.
Yes, it is. Yeah, and if you wouldn't know it was there, right, you wouldn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's amazing. We've got people stopping by and showing support. They're actually looking up where it's at because it's out of the way.
All right.
Okay, so what do you think is going to happen next? What would you like to see happen? Just whatever you'd like the listeners to know, and maybe what they could do, you know, to help out in any way.
We've got a negotiation meeting set up for Tuesday the 13th.
Mm-hmm.
Back with the company. We're actually going to be negotiating at the company. And if people want to just keep showing up and showing support for the guys, it would be greatly appreciated.
Okay. And anything else that you'd like to let the listeners know about? I mean, I feel like, you know, I told you that I could squeeze you in here. This was kind of unexpected, but, you know, we kind of like that here. When it's something really, you know, pressing local that comes up, we're always willing to kind of, you know, shuffle things around. And, you know, if you want to talk
some more. Well, that's people need to remember that this is a local station. We're local people. We'll talk about worldwide issues, but this is a local manifestation of a worldwide neoliberalism issue.
That's a very good point, Bill. You know, this is a Canadian company that bought out a local company. It was started back in the early 1920s.
Yeah.
And this is similar to what happened over in Decatur, Illinois, with A.E. Staley when they were bought out by the British multinational Tate & Lyle.
That's right. And ironically, there is an old A.E. Staley Hulk out there, abandoned Hulk,
uh-huh,
which is now owned by Sport. Concrete.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that those bins down there, those used to be A.E. Staley.
Okay.
Silos.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this seems like it's a growing trend, a phenomena, you know, where you got more and more multinational corporations buying out locally regional corporations, and it seems like this sort of thing always happens. You know, it's always seems like it takes a turn for the worse when that sort of thing happens as far as the workers and you know, the community in general.
Yeah, and I will say, I mean, the last strike they had out there was in the 80s, and we've had pretty good relationships. I mean, the negotiations in the past have always gone pretty well. This was just a very unusual negotiation.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, that's the thing is, the whole, how should I put, the whole worldwide economic system that's set up. I mean, really, there's so much, it almost has it's almost an entity of its own to where, you know, corporations and stuff are constantly, being, you know, there's this constant dog-eat-dog competition, and, you know, the problem is, you know, they move, if they like offshore and stuff, and they go to places like Mexico or Asia, where workers get a lot less money per hour, you know, it just pits working people against working people worldwide.
The quality of the product, I mean, it's dropped down, and it's not those people's fault. It's of these companies, they also, when they do that, they start cheapening on the materials,
mm-hmm.
you know?
another local company like that, Prairie Central, owned by a Mexican company now, I believe.
Really?
About the last 5 years,
what,
something like that.
The concrete company?
Yeah.
It was
owned
by a Greek guy last time I knew.
Yeah. Now I think it's owned by a Mexican company that has several other conglomerations like that too. Once again, a foreign national company like that.
Okay, Ron, if there's anything else, you would like the listeners to know, thank you so much for coming in. And just to let you know, we're here, you know, if anything, you know, breaking comes up, get a hold of me and we'll definitely make room for you or, you know, one of your, you know, executive board members of the local or whatever, you know, the case.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate you guys having us or having me here and getting this out to the community.
Oh, by the way, folks, if you want to know what they do at Clifford Jacobs, here's the description on their website. Die forging is a manufacturing process by which metal is pressed, pounded, or squeezed under great pressure into high-strength parts known as forging. The process is normally but not always performed by preheating the metal to a desired temperature before it is worked. Actually, it does not sound like very pleasant conditions to work under.
Yeah.
And I would like to comment on that. I mean, it's a very hot, specialized job, hard labor. I mean, it's very noisy. When those hammers are running out there, the ground shakes.
Oh.
I mean, it's impressive.
I do some work out there at the CN yard, you know, and it's kind of noisy there, but that Clifford Jacobs forging beats it, you know, for sure. A lot louder there. Yeah. And just stamping.
Okay, Ron, thanks so much for coming in. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on List Support Community Radio Station, WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois at 90.1 FM and webcast live worldwide at WTEFT.org. We're going to take a quick music break. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
My dream, it lingered near.
Okay, that was Patti Smith, People Have the Power. And just real quickly, I want like the listeners to know that Clifford and Jacob's Forging Company locked out workers. They'll be having a vigil outside their gates here, a community rally, actually, coming up this Tuesday, October 13th at 8 a.m. at the Clifford and Jacob's plant, which is 2410 North 5th Street in Champaign. And so just let you know if you got, if you can make it out there at 8 o'clock or show up before 8 this coming Tuesday, October 13th. I'd really appreciate it, because there's going to be negotiations going on inside, and they want to have a big show of support, community support, while those negotiations are happening inside the plant.
Yep. It's going to be big.
Everybody. Yeah. Yeah. Get out there.
Please get out there.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Gus, what's new this week?
Yeah, we got an update. We got an update with our favorite anti-worker, Dennis Williams.
Anti-worker union official.
Anti-working union official. On Friday afternoon, yesterday, the United Auto Workers, Dennis Williams, in other words, published a 20-page highlighter of the new tentative agreement between the union and Fiat Chrysler. Notice I didn't say the workers and Fiat Chrysler. I said the union and Fiat Chrysler. Despite efforts by the UAW to portray the new deal in the rosiest of terms, the agreement is practically identical to the one they tried to ram through 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. In a signed letter, Dennis Williams and Vice President Norwood Jewell called the agreement one of the richest ever negotiated. This, like everything else the UAW has said to workers over the last 3 weeks, is a bold-faced lie. None of the main demands of the workers have been met in the new deal, which enshrines multiple tiers, maintains the alternative work schedule, does not include cost of living adjustments, gives nothing to retirees, threatens pensions, and allows the company to fire workers for attendance problems. On top of this, the proposed contract threatens substantial job cuts and may force many workers to move their families across the country. Furthermore, the UAW has once again provided only highlights of a deal that workers are expected to labor under for 4 years. The UAW was forced to give up the full contract before the last vote, and workers should not have to vote again until they have had ample time to see and read through the whole contract. But Dennis Williams does not want that. Here are some of the actual highlights of the proposed agreement. If you have a chance, you can go online and actually read it. Number one, enshrined multi-tier system with limited raises over 8 years. Number two, no changes to tier one wages from last proposed agreement. So they did nothing to change that, which was a big issue for the workers. Number three, no cap on the percentage of tier two workers, which is a complete disgrace to any working group, especially auto workers. Number four, no change to alternative work schedule, no cost of living adjustment, firing for absentees and tardiness, nothing for retirees, scant protection for cuts to pensions. I mean, this is really, we're looking at just scaling back any type of progress that the UAW has made over the past 50 years with this agreement. So I don't expect anything less than the workers to vote this down as the other proposal. I don't know what Dennis Williams is thinking he's going to get the push through, but the workers are united against this garbage.
I've seen this phenomenon happen before. Basically, it's nicknamed Vote Till You Get It Right.
Yeah.
And they'll go in there, and I mean, it's amazing what they'll do sometimes. I mean, just that bold-faced lie to the members. They'll pull groups of them aside, try to find differences amongst the rank and file to exploit, and it gets really underhanded, which, you know, this is a real symptom of what's wrong with the system of the American labor movement and labor law in general in this country that needs to be definitely reformed.
Yeah.
So, in the benefit of the workers. A lot of stuff we could go into. We could almost do a whole program on this. So, but anyway, Bob, what's new this week with you,
well,
so to speak?
In Atlanta on Monday, these 12 nations got together, and they're pleased to announce they've successfully concluded the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations.
Yes.
That was stated by the U.S. Trade Representative Michael Froman early Monday morning. 12 countries, Australia, Brunei, Canada, Chile, Japan, Malaysia, Mexico, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, and the United States and Vietnam. So this ministerial meeting in Atlanta was expected to conclude actually last Friday, but dragged on to Monday morning because of disagreements on dairy products and pharmaceutical regulation. The controversial trade agreement must now be approved by the 12 individual nation states before it can officially become law. So in the United States, President Obama must wait a minimum of 90 days before signing the agreement, and the full text of the agreement must be made publicly available for at least 60 days. So we're finally going to get a chance to actually look at some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This means a congressional vote on the TPP will not likely happen before January. President Obama promised Congress and the American people who have months to read every word and stated that passing the agreement can help our businesses sell more made in America goods and services around the world.
Yeah, right.
President Obama actually signed into law the so-called Fast Track Bill that sets the stage for the approval of the TPP. The Fast Track Bill is officially known as the Trade Promotion Authority, the TPA, was one of two bills signed by Obama. The president also signed the Trade Adjustment Assistance Act, the TAA, aimed at extending aid to workers who might lose their jobs as a consequence of the TPP or other so-called free trade deals. So yeah, they already know people are going to be losing their jobs.
Yeah, that's a pretty good point.
Well, here's the Assistance Act. Go to junior college or go to get ripped off by a private college and learn how to do something with computers.
And, you know, this is the same thing that happened with NAFTA, and that didn't pan out very well.
Yeah.
You know, what we got since NAFTA was passed back in 1994 is like over across the board 10 to 15% reduction in manufacturing, U.S. manufacturing wages, 2 million lost jobs. I mean, basically going from a you know, an economy in the late basically through the 70s and 80s and before to where you had a lot of even the non-union you know, manufacturing plants paid livable wages, and now it's like we've gone into this low-wage service economy, you know.
So at Monday's press conference, the U.S. Trade Representative Michael Froman said that this will affect 40% of the global economy. He goes on with some rhetoric about higher-paying jobs, enhanced innovation, productivity and competitiveness, raise living standards, reduce poverty and stuff, you know. But critics say the agreement's investor-state dispute settlement, or ISDS, will give corporations loopholes to escape accountability and empower international bodies overriding national sovereignty of the signing nations. We've discussed that here before.
Yep. National, so, state, and local laws will be basically overruled.
Right.
Even voter referendums.
Where's all the people who freak out about Agenda 21?
And what is Agenda 21?
Agenda 21 was something that was written in the early 90s. It's the United Nations, sort of an advisory thing. It's not really like a treaty or anything. Anything else on how we should proceed in terms of planning, especially urban planning and so on, in order to foster a better environment for everybody. And a lot of people are always freaking out, right-wingers always freaking out about how it's taking away our sovereignty and they're going to force all of us to live in little bitty apartments and kill people off so that we can have more wild areas and so on.
You know,
and basically it's about more bike paths usually is what happens. And nobody has to do anything that it says.
Yeah.
You see.
So in February, the Washington Post revealed that the U.S. government's numbers on the job increases are not factually correct. Secretary of State and Secretary of Agriculture claimed that the agreement would create 650,000 new jobs. The Washington Post said that the result would be a net number of zero new jobs.
What type of jobs will those be?
Yeah.
Low wage service. Oh,
yeah.
Service,
exactly.
You know. And,
well, here's another aspect of it too. When they're talking about, American exports, I think a lot of what they're thinking about now are really high end sort of consulting kind of things.
Yep.
You see? And that's where they want to get services under, trade.
You know, under the intellectual property.
Right, which doesn't help us at all.
No, no. This is the bottom line is these trade treaties benefit corporate profits, corporate power, you know, and it works against working people and democracy in general. I mean, that's pretty much and it's going to severely push down our standard of living. You know, I don't know if I want to get into the whole thing about all the pharmaceutical and healthcare aspects of the TPP.
National Nurses United came out immediately afterwards and urged Congress members to reject the TPP. Because of inadequate guarantees to assure patients and consumers will not be harmed by pharmaceutical price gouging. Mm-hmm. And that's our friends at NNU, National Nurses United.
Yep. And I've also heard that there's going to be provisions in there that's going to make it even more difficult for the United States as a country or individual states to enact their own single-payer health care systems. They're going to basically try to claim, it's going to infringe on the profits of these existing health care corporations. You know, it's like, well, too friggin' bad, but, let's talk about what's, and that's the thing is what's in the best interest of the American people, not what's in the best interest of multinational corporations.
There's an old saying, it's capitalism for the regular people, but socialism for the rich.
Yeah.
This is nationalism for the regular people,
mm-hmm.
and the dissolution of borders for the rich.
Yes.
And that's, It's a similar, I think it's very comparable in the same way. It's the same attitude.
Indeed.
And the same effect on the people. We have less freedom and less well-being.
Exactly. I got a real quick news story here before the caller calls in. It's from France. Two Air France senior executives were stripped of much of their clothing by a frenzied, irate crowd protesting massive job cuts at the airline.
Have you seen the video?
No, I haven't.
Oh, man, they really ripped. That's true. Ripped their suits right off, man.
A meeting of the Central Committee in Roserie in France came to an abrupt conclusion when the crowd of about 100 furious worker protesters swooped towards Air France Assistant Human Resources Director Xavier Brossetta, peeled his shirt and tie from his body and forced him to escape with the assistance of security guards. Likewise, the head of Air France in Orly, Pierre Plisnoyer, had to seek safety with a boost from security over a fence after his shirt and suit coat were reduced to shreds at the hands of the incensed crowd. CEO Frederic Gaguet fared a little better, having left the room before the violent outburst at the works meeting. And so anyway, you wanted to get that
story. Yeah, you might remember a few years ago.
I'm sorry. Yeah. We got to take this call.
Right, take it.
Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Anyway, a few years ago, CEOs were taken hostage.
Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Yeah, this is Mark Dudzik.
Hi, Mark, how you doing?
All right.
Okay, would you like to introduce yourself to the listeners?
Sure. This is Mark Dudzik. I'm the National Coordinator of the Labor Campaign for Single-Payer Healthcare.
Okay, very good. So, you've called into the show before a couple times and everything, and I wanted to have you call in again today just because, there's something that's going to be happening here at the end of the month. You'd like to let the listeners know what that is?
Sure, yeah. Right in Chicago from October 30th to November 1st, we are going to be co-sponsoring a national single-payer strategy conference. This is really the first time in memory that a number of different single-payer advocacy organizations have gotten together to hold a joint meeting to figure out sort of where we are and how we can keep moving on towards healthcare justice. So it's a very exciting event that's coming up.
Okay, and of course, since I've gotten on the National Labor Campaign for Single Payer Steering Committee, I think it was back in May or June, my first conference call, I was really surprised about how many different states have been moving quite a ways along mm-hmm. on the single payer, front, trying to get, various legislation enacted and stuff. Could you give a listeners a little synopsis of kind of what's been happening around the country?
Well, there are probably 30 states that have some legislation submitted that would enact a publicly financed universal health care system for all of the residents of their state. And they're at various degrees of development. We had the one that went furthest in recent history was in the state of Vermont, which passed legislation that would enact a statewide universal health care program in 2017. Now, that suffered some setbacks recently where the governor has been really pressured by the Koch brothers and a bunch of other right-wing and health care industry forces, and he's kind of backing away from it. So there's sort of a crisis moment in Vermont that it's one of the things we want to talk about at this conference. But meanwhile, right across the border in New York State, this past spring, the state assembly passed a single-payer bill called New York Health, which would make health care a right for everybody in the state. And activists are ramping up to try to get it through the state Senate in the next session. On the West Coast, there's there's really strong state single-payer campaigns going on in Washington State, in Oregon, and in California. Minnesota is looking at what they need to do to enact a single-payer program. So there's a bunch of activities around the country.
Yes, indeed. Now, you know, in the case of Vermont, I didn't know that the Koch brothers had come into play as far as putting pressure on Sumlin. I think it's his name, the governor elected, recently elected.
Sumlin, yeah.
Recently elected in Vermont. I heard that there was things going on behind the scenes with the Obama administration, too, as far as withholding of federal Medicaid funding and that sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, one of the problems that you have when you try to establish a state publicly financed healthcare system is that you have all these funding streams coming from the federal government into your state regarding healthcare, from Medicaid and TRICARE and CHIPS and Medicare and federal employees' health benefits and a number of other sources. And so you have to try to figure out how to consolidate those streams so that you can, have a single-payer system and kind of rationally plan it. And there were some difficulties that the Obama administration was putting up regarding integrating the Medicare portion of federal funding into the state health care program, into Green Mountain Care. So, you know, there's some complexities there. And, you know, we have Congressman Jim McDermott, who's a congressman from the Seattle area in Washington State, just introduced legislation in the U.S. Congress called the State-Based Universal Health Care Act of 2015 that would make it a lot easier for states to establish single-payer universal health care systems. And Congressman McDermott will be at our conference in Chicago, and we'll be talking about this bill and why this is so important to move our movement forward.
Okay, so, you know, I guess this would be a good point to kind of transition into one thing that's going to be coming up here fairly quickly in 2008, and that's the excise tax under the ACA, and otherwise Obamacare, otherwise known as the Cadillac tax. I've done a little research on this. Of course, the National Labor Campaign for Single Payers got some really good resources. If anyone would like to go check out their website, it explains a lot about this. But one thing I love is, as far as how this starts out, when it talks about turning Chevys into Cadillacs, would you like to start from there?
Yeah, well, the Cadillac tax is going to be a tax on decent quality working class health care that's going to begin in 2018. And it's a 40% tax, so it's a huge new cost on already endangered health care programs. When they conceived of this tax, the way they tried to sell it to the American people was by calling it a Cadillac tax, as if, you know, the kind of plans that they were going to tax were luxury plans, only that the privileged and the spoiled have, and that, you know, it would bring everybody down a peg. But in fact, when you take a look at the type of plans that this is going to affect, it's really going to affect the Chevy plans, the decent but not extravagant health care plans that workers have fought to win and to hold on to over decades of struggle in the workplace. These are plans that a lot of workers have traded off wage increases and other benefits in order to maintain. And now, you know, after all this sacrifice, now under the ACA, these plans could be taxed, and the amounts over the caps could be taxed at 40%, which is driving many employers to come back in and cut these plans and shift costs onto the backs of their employees in order to avoid paying this tax.
Yes, as like a union plumber friend of mine said, he goes, to call my health insurance plan through my union a Cadillac, it's really more like a Pinto. Some of you young people out there, a Pinto was a very cheap car that was made by Ford Motor Company for a while back in the 70s.
Even worse, it's a Chevette.
Yeah, Chevette, okay.
But actually, the Chevettes didn't kill you as bad as the Pintos with the exploding gas tanks.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. So, but anyway, yes, and you know, there's some other things here too. I mean, kind of going to the you know, the heart of this is that, you know, this additional revenue, is needed, because the ACA or otherwise Obamacare attempts to expand health insurance coverage, without disrupting the profit-driven, private insurance industry in this country. Mm-hmm. And it continues to rely on employment-based coverage, to provide most of it, Americans' health insurance, but at the same time undermines these very benefits in order to pay subsidies, to private insurance companies or states or whatever to purchase, for people to purchase inferior types of private insurance, through the Obamacare exchanges. I mean, it's just like, you know, this bill, I mean, talks out both sides of its mouth. And in the essence, you know, I'm just reading between the lines. It seems like this whole bill was written to basically undermine any kind of, non-profit or cooperative based health insurance, systems, you know, done by unions or whatever, and to basically, drive them out of business in order to expand the, private corporate health insurance industry in this country. Am I off base here, Mark, or?
No, you pretty much nailed it, David. I mean, the Affordable Care Act does a number of good things. It does expand access healthcare to people, but it's based on this really flawed model. And the model is that, you know, you should treat healthcare as a commodity, that it should be bought and sold, you know, in the for-profit marketplace, and that it should be subject to the same kind of market disciplines that other commodities are subject to. And when you try to do that, you end up with all these crazy distortions. You know, we think healthcare ought to be treated like a public good, like education and firefighting and public libraries. It should be publicly funded through an equitable financing system and available to you when you need it at no financial barriers. You know, when your house is on fire, you don't call five different firefighting companies to see who gives you the best price. You call the fire department, and they don't ask for a copay. They come and they put out the fire. And that's what people should expect and are entitled to in their health care.
And it exists in every industrialized, advanced country in the world, I think, except South Africa, and even exists in some lesser developed countries. You know, so why can't we have it? So, Bill, I'm sorry, you wanted to ask a question?
Well, I have a market distortion to describe that happened to me this week. What happened is, I work out of the laborers' union, and I've been cutting back my hours due to my age, basically. And so I've been having to self-pay on my insurance sometimes. Mm-hmm. Well, what happens is they don't tell you that your insurance is run out until the day it runs out. Then they mail the letter to you. All right, because they don't know. They might get hours in, mm-hmm. you see. And, of course, I could probably set up a spreadsheet and keep track of all this, but I'm a laborer, okay? But what happened was I had a conflict with that and a prescription I needed for a skin condition I have involving my hands, which is a little bit work related. Mm-hmm. And it's a tube of ointment, okay?
Right.
It doesn't look anything special at all. It's got a really long fancy name, but it's just really nothing. And I went to the pharmacy and a Walgreens. And the guy goes, I don't know if you want to buy this on your own. And I said, why is that? And he goes, because it's $500.
Whoa.
And, you know, so I about kind of freaked out. Well, I need to make a $302 payment to the insurance plan. And the best way I could, the fastest, and they don't take electronic payments. I had to take a half hour off work, go to the laborer's hall with a certified check, have that check faxed to the insurance people. So then, and give the check to the people at the laborers hall so that they'd trust they would get the money and let me get this, ointment with the $15 copay. But here's the thing. I am real sure that the insurance company doesn't pay anywhere close to $500 for that.
Yep.
And that this, cause they do the negotiations, you know, in bulk, and that this is really kind of a form, not of distortion, but extortion to make you buy insurance.
Well, Bill, I guess you literally have skin in the game here, don't you? As far as this healthcare, cause that's, you know, I hate that term. You know, I don't know what angered me more. Obama coming out right before the Affordable Care Act was pushed through the committee saying about calling things a Cadillac tax, or this whole thing about that people have to have skin in the game to make our health care. Well, I mean, they're both horrible, horrible, and barbaric, actually, neoliberal terminology and concepts here.
And this is, you know, it's also a little bit stressful. You don't have to deal with it. I had to take more time. I had to go to the bank and get a certified check. I had to go to the laborers' hall. I had to do all of that. You know, and I think it, and, you know, for something that, I'm sure many Americans feel should be a right to be, yep. to be taken care of, your health.
It's barbaric, your right and to it's life. Wasteful.
Yeah.
You know, it's all of those steps that you had to take, you know, involved, you know, time and money and stuff. It's just, it's a wasteful system. We spend 30% of all of our healthcare money on administrative waste and inefficiency. You could cover everybody in America and eliminate everybody's copays just with the amount that we would save on administrative waste in a rational healthcare system. So,
well, you know, here's another one too, and this is something that comes up with sort of a sister issue, which is Social Security. Mm-hmm. And if we could have Medicare for all people, oh, how will it be paid for? Well, what you do is you raise the cap on the insurance from $118,300
on Social Security,
on mm-hmm. the payroll tax mm-hmm. cap, and you never hear anybody in the not that much even in the alternative media discuss that.
Mm. Yep.
Yeah. So, yeah. Mark, I guess, yeah, I'm sure you know. You talk to people just on a regular basis, people just within, you know, any individual's sort of circle, and you're constantly bumping into these healthcare horror stories. You know, I mean, other than the waste, I mean, it's just barbaric. I mean, that people have to suffer, you know, from totally unnecessary things if they could get the health access to healthcare, and not to mention the, 40,000-50,000 people who die every year in this country, from, you know, unnecessarily because of, treatable stuff.
Mm-hmm. Every family has the stories, David. That's what's why this issue is so important and resonates, and why we continue to fight on. You know, every family can tell you healthcare horror stories.
Indeed. Now, so, what can people, the listeners out there, do? I mean, right now. I mean, of course, this conference is coming up here in about 3 weeks in Chicago. But of course, that's not going to be an end all. That's really kind of just a beginning, if you will, expansion. What is it people could do? I mean, your average person out there, maybe that's listening right now.
Well, if you're a union member, you know, you should go to your union and ask them what they're doing about this, and volunteer to help work with their programs. If they're actively working on single payer, you know, ask them what you can do to volunteer. If you're in a community, you know, look around for a community organization that's engaged in this. Learn some stuff. Learn how to talk to groups about this. Go out and talk to your church groups and your community organizations. You know, we have to build this movement from the grassroots out. You know, we've got to educate ourselves around healthcare. And we've got to organize ourselves around it, because, you know, in the end, this is a fight against the medical industrial complex, and it's one of the most powerful corporate conglomerations in the history of capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
The only way we're going to beat it is with people power. We need our unions there, because they're the ones with the resources and the organizing capacity, and then we need to reach out into our communities and organize real people to demand that their needs be met.
Okay.
Those are the kind of things we're going to be talking about at the conference at the end of this month in Chicago.
Okay. Is there a website people could go to?
Well, you can go to our website, laborforsinglepayer.org. We have some information there about the healthcare crisis, and it also, right on the front page of the site, there's information on how to register for the Chicago conference if people are interested in going. And then there's a number of other great websites that, you know, really walk you through a lot of these issues. The Physicians for a National Health program probably has the best sort of research and educational materials on their site, and that's PNHP.org, and that stands for Physicians for a National Health Program. These are doctors, over 20,000 doctors, who believe that we ought to have a single-payer healthcare system in this country. They'll be meeting with us in Chicago at the end of the month.
Yeah, and real quickly, wasn't there a bunch of medical students around the country just this, like about a week ago, that kind of had a huge series of demonstrations all over the country?
Yeah, this was really inspiring. There was a hundreds of medical students at over 30 medical schools on October 1st at a 10-1 for healthcare day. And they all came out, and, you know, did some educationals and, active, organizing of other students around why, students need to be fighting for healthcare for all. So it was a really, you know, all these organizations and all of these groups around the country are, you know, kind of coming together around these issues.
Okay, and I just want to add, too, that for people who live in Illinois, you can also, besides the websites Mark just mentioned, you can also go to the, you can Google in Illinois Single Payer Coalition, which is based in Chicago, and, of course, there's members downstate here as well. So there's a lot of, you know, this is the thing, is this is not getting hardly any media attention out there, even in the so-called progressive media, but it's a growing movement, and I think, you know, eventually we're going to, I guess, break through those iron court, or I call them iron curtains of corporate media out there, it's just you know, the more the movement grows, the more difficult it's going to make for them to be able to ignore us. So, Mark, thank you so much for calling in, and we'll see you in Chicago.
It's always a pleasure, David, and I'll see you all in Chicago.
All right, take care.
Bye now.
Bye.
It's drastic time for sure. We need an antidote and a cure. Cause do you really think Muhammad got a problem with Jehovah? We don't want war. Imagine if every prophet was alive. And current days amongst you and I. You think they would view life like you and I do? Or would they sit and contemplate on why do we live this way? Act and behave this way. We still living primitive today. Cause a piece of the destination in war can't be the way. There's no way. So people just be a woman, be a man. Realize that you can change the world by changing yourself. And understand that we all just the same. So when I count to three, let's change.
Time for grand philosophy. I'll barely keep my head above the tide. I got this mortgage, got three kids.
How many of you know what your initial benefit is going to be? Leave your hand up. How many of you know what your initial benefit? You actually know. Do you know too? But nobody else in this room knows, because we usually don't know. Now, what if I told you your initial benefit was going to be somewhat lower in order to save the program? Would that drive you crazy? Or would it upset you? Okay. Well, you'd get over it. you're going to have to get over
folks,
it.
Folks, this is John Kasich, Republican presidential candidate, presently governor of Ohio, I believe. Who did get his butt kicked by unions last year over the right to, was that right to work?
Yes, it was a voter referendum. Ohio's state constitution allowed that to happen, and yeah, it was an overwhelming defeat for him.
But I was looking for more of that video, like maybe the whole show, because I wanted to see somewhere if maybe the person interviewing him might have brought up that they wouldn't have to cut Social Security if they would raise the limit on the payroll tax.
Basically, right now, for those who don't know, anybody who earns over $118,000 a year, I should say the portion of their income over $118,000 is not subjected to the Social Security tax withholding, which is ridiculous because, you know, in all the other industrialized countries, it doesn't matter. There is no cap like that. You make a certain percentage, you know, you make a certain amount of money, you get taxed on that regardless.
Yeah.
From Social Security.
And look how regressive it is. And it's not just workers. It's small business people, too, have to pay this.
Yeah, I'm self-employed
people. And it's 12.4%. Yeah. That is a very onerous tax. They keep talking all the time about the income tax, how the income tax stifles businesses and innovation and creativity. And we would have jobs falling out of the sky like manna from heaven if we would get rid of income taxes. But look at this payroll tax. How hard it is. Look, small business people, not only do you have to pay it on yourself, then you have to pay the 6.2% half, theoretically, of your employees.
Yeah, Bob's,
payroll tax.
Bob's self-employed, himself and him and his company.
And I pay that tax every year.
Yeah.
Out of pocket, man. I mean, I hate to have to do that. It's, I mean, everybody's like, you know, they don't,
Okay, folks, we're gonna open up the phone lines. You can call in here at 217-3, actually 217-FLY-LIVE, and we'd love to hear from you. Gus, I guess, real quick, Gus, before I get to you, I just want to get this in real quick, public service announcements. The Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center is celebrating its 15th anniversary. It started last night, and it's going to go on all through today and until tomorrow afternoon on Sunday. So get over there at 202 South Broadway in Urbana. It's the downtown Urbana post office, and Urbana-Champaign IMC was started right after the WTO protests out in Seattle, Washington in 1999, and a lot of people from Champaign-Urbana went out there to protest with tens of thousands of other people from around the country and around the world, and after their experience there, they came back and opened the Independent Media Center, which actually was launched in early 2001. So get over there. There's going to be a lot of good stuff going on. That's today and tomorrow, 202 South Broadway, downtown Urbana post office.
WEFT has a table out there today at the CU Bands and Fans fundraiser over at the City Center.
Okay.
Next to Fat City. That's going on this evening and tomorrow, I believe, too. So we got a table out there. Some of our air shifters are going to be there.
Okay.
Oh, good.
Good deal. Okay, Gus, I know you probably got a lot of other stuff here that you weren't able to mention earlier. So what else has been happening?
There's been a lot happening. I know a lot of people know that the 20th anniversary of the original Million Man March is happening right now as we speak.
Okay.
So I just want to tell listeners to tune in next week as I will do a critical analysis of the Million Man March, the original 1995 one, and the one from that's happening today, so people can understand that I would argue that it's probably the least progressive movement or event that's ever happened in the 20th century.
Really?
And we'll find out about that next week, so make sure you tune in to it.
Okay.
But something else that happened this past week that a lot of people are somewhat talking about is the death of Grace Lee Boggs.
Oh, yes.
She passed away on October 5th. A very dynamic individual in terms of she experienced a life of shifting politics and shifting understandings of oppression.
Now, she was just turned 100 years old, didn't she?
Yeah, she turned 100. Wow. Died right after she turned 100. So, yeah, she lived a very intense and just hands-on life with a lot of different movements and a lot of different groups. So I just wanted to kind of put her into historical context and actually for people that don't know how she shifted from one to the other, because those that don't know, she moved more so towards a more right wing policy right before she in the past few years of her last life. Yeah, so
didn't Malcolm X, when he was murdered, wasn't she there and actually was he died in her arms, right? Because she was real close to that whole the Black Power movement in New York City and I think around the country and stuff.
Yeah, well, you know, she's gonna move away from that stuff a lot of, that's something that happens somewhat with a lot of individuals from that time period, in terms of leadership roles. Mm-hmm. But basically just starting off, she's a Chinese woman and she as a youth, she experienced a lot of racist and sexual discrimination because of her, ethnicity. you know, so, and then she read a lot about, Marxism and really got it really into it. She couldn't find a job when she was really young. She became involved in protesting, particularly bad housing in Chicago. And that led her to start meeting with a lot of, on the ground black groups in Chicago.
And this would have been the 1930s,
yeah,
right?
This is the 1930s.
Yeah, yeah, so during the 1930s.
Mm-hmm. And then when she started becoming a part of, A. Philip Randolph's March on Washington movement, and it taught her the truth as powerful as Marx and Hegel would quote, I found out if you mobilize a mass action, you can change the world. So she really got into organizing the masses and things like that throughout the 40s and 50s. And people were mobilizing, particularly in auto worker-centric Detroit, which is where she's going to go next. She went there to be where the workers are and to edit a workers' newspaper called Correspondence. That's where she met Jimmy Boggs, a black auto worker and Marxist thinker, who became a reporter for her. And by the end of their first date, they were engaged. Mm-hmm. So they were wedded, and they were in activism for over 40 years until Jimmy Boggs died in 1993. So this was a time of leaflets, word of mouth organizing, radical newspapers and magazines, union organizing, and post-World War II organizing protests, most notably that of the bus boycott in Alabama that a young reverend down there started.
Yeah.
You know, she went down there and was a part of that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's where things start getting a little interesting for Boggs. She was one of the organizers of the Detroit 1963 Civil Rights March, where King spoke and gave an early version of I Have a Dream speech for those. So a lot of people think that King just came up with it there at the March on Washington, but he actually had an earlier version that he presented there. So when the Boggses were actually excluded from that actual movement, they were deemed too radical.
Uh-huh.
A lot of the Marxist groups during that march and throughout the country during the civil rights movement were actually banned from different areas by civil rights leaders because they were too radical.
And wasn't one of Martin Luther King's main advisors and organizers, Baynard Rustin, I think his name was.
Yeah,
they put also
a member of CORE.
Yeah.
You know, he was the leader of CORE as well.
And they put a lot of pressure for Dr. King to basically get rid of him too, right?
Yeah. He was also gay too.
Yeah, he was gay and he was a leftist. So
that really meant something back then.
Exactly. And that was huge. So that was something that the Boggs experienced, and it kind of shifted a lot of their politics. And this is what happened with a lot of leaders during the civil rights movement. They felt that they were betrayed and disillusioned by the civil rights leaders. So that's when you have the Black Power era that's going to form out of this disillusionment from the civil rights movement. And that's where both Boggses go to. They start organizing with Black Power. They start meeting with Malcolm X and talking with different groups that are talking about self-determination, mm-hmm, and community organizing and looking at housing, labor, police violence, the things that affect the working class black people. Whereas in the civil rights movement was strictly about multicultural utopianism, mm-hmm, and all that, you know, nonviolence and all this other stuff. So, And it really comes through a historic rebellion of 1967, which is a really massive insurrection of working class black people challenging their position in the social organization of the city. And it destroyed a lot of the issues. It destroyed a lot of the city infrastructure. So it forced her to really think about what kind of change was possible and what took. So violence became a question. That was my computer. Violence became a central issue and problem for Grace Lee Boggs. And she had to question it. And I quote her, "I think we realize that a rebellion is an outburst of anger, but not a revolution. Revolution is evolution towards something much grander in terms of what it means to be a human being." So over the next 40 years or so, her home was a place where people of all races and ages would come and talk strategy. So after the Detroit Rebellion, she's going to kind of shift more towards a multicultural working class opposition. So she's changing her ideology again. So, and this is the part that gets really interesting about her. So in 1960, let me back up a bit, because her affiliation with C.L.R. James is important. Grace and James Bogg broke with C.L.R. James, who was working with the Trotskyists back in the 1960s. And C.L.R. James, those that haven't read Black Jacobins, he's a major black Marxist who argued about working class resistance and revolution being the only means to end capitalist profit system. And that was always his biggest thing. And he participated in a lot of anti-colonial movements. Grace Lee Boggs was involved in that as well. But by 1963, when they broke apart, that's also going to play a part in how she shifts more away from violence.
And C.L.R. James wrote a history of the Haitian Revolution.
Yeah, Black Jacobins.
Considered, okay, I wanted to make sure that's what that was.
Oh, of course.
Just for the listeners, it's considered one of the best authorities on that history, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, it's considered one of the greatest histories ever written. So, okay. You know, it's up there. So in 1970s, when they moved further to the right toward full accommodation with the capitalist status quo, and this is something that it meant, this is the kind of thing they were advocating by the end of the 1970s. Grace Lee Boggs creating models of work, education, art, and community that would transform the rebels who advocated revolution and filled with righteous anger and actually change them into productive agents who understood that self-transformation and structural transformation must go hand in hand. Now, this is important. This type of outlook meant a total rejection of class struggle and a turn towards individualistic self-development. So what Grace Lee Boggs does at the end of the 1970s is she shifts from class struggle being the central focus of, or in other words, leaving Marxism and going into this idea of individualistic self-development, this idea of uplift ideology. So it's just a really interesting, the thing is that I want to emphasize is that we need to make sure that we always read our different scholars. Grace Lee Boggs did a lot of great things, but she did shift many times throughout her life. So
okay, hold that thought, guys. Let's take this call.
Sort of like a hip Gregory, diet.
Exactly.
Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Jim Iman.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, Jim Iman. C.L.R. James was also a union organizer among farm workers in Arkansas, in rice fields, and was rather successful. He's written several books, and I have to agree, outside of Trotsky's History of the Russian Revolution, probably is one of the best books ever written. Now, on the question of single payer, for those of you that don't have any kind of health care or, you know, Obamacare, actually what Obamacare did, one good thing was to include people with pre-existing conditions. Otherwise, I know this for a fact because of Christie Clinic, where I go to way too often because of my disability, that it has tripled the paperwork.
Uh-huh.
Tripled the paperwork. So nurses and doctors are so busy doing paperwork that they don't have time to properly take care of their patients.
Mm-hmm.
This is just a disaster. I mean, I hate to agree with the Republicans on this, but it's a train wreck.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because a couple weeks ago there was somebody here at the station that has a program on the air here. I'm not going to mention his name, but he happens to teach somewhere, he knows people really well in the insurance industry. I'm talking about pretty high up the food chain, if you will, in the insurance industry. And he said they told him, face to face, a couple of them said, yeah, we were supposed to pretend, to be opposed to this, Obamacare bill, Affordable Care Act. Really, it's been a boom to our industry.
Sure,
I mean, pretend to be opposed to it, you know, so you gotta wonder, like a lot of things, Jim, how much of this, so-called, the whole narrative the corporate media sets up, you know, is that, you know, Democrat, this linear, reality, if you will, that, you know, bad Republicans, good Democrats, fighting between good and evil, when we know the fact that most of the times it's a dog and pony show.
Of course.
Yeah.
Getting back to the healthcare thing.
Indeed.
I've always advocated self-socialization of medicine. In other words, you get the treatment, then you get the bill, and you wait, and you don't pay it.
Oh, I see. So you're talking about a general strike of people out there who use medical care and stuff. I think there was a similar proposal for student debts, just basically a general strike. You know, I think this is some great ideas. The problem is organizing for it, because when everybody's out there facing the debt collectors, the courts, and everything else on their own, it's a pretty daunting endeavor, if you will, to say the least. But, man, if somebody could organize something like that, it'd probably be really push forward. Very quickly, the change we need in this country, both healthcare and as well as a higher education.
Right. That's from the movement point of view, and I agree with you completely, that's what has to be done. It's a strike, mm-hmm. in effect, because you're not paying the bills.
Yeah.
But in lieu of that, individuals can do that same thing.
Yes.
So if you get taken, if you get called into court, you go in and you say, I can't pay.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll reassign another date, and then you go back and say, well, you either hire an attorney, or you say, well, I still can't pay. Well, you're going to have to pay something, Mr. Eisenman. Well, $15, no, that won't work. Can you do 40? Yeah, I can do 40. So you make one payment of $40, then you don't pay again.
But the problem with that, Jim, is that once you agree to those payments in court, that if you don't make the payments in a timely manner, then you're in contempt of court. You know, the thing is, a lot of people don't understand too is that what is usual and customary is that you can negotiate debt owed, you know, down to as little as 25 cents in the dollar too, with the
creditor. I'm not sure you're right about that, but I'll take your word for it.
Well, if I'm wrong, I'd like to be corrected. But listen, Jim, we're going to kind of move on here. Gus wants to kind of finish up here on Gracie Boggs, but any last comments you'd like to say for listeners?
One thing that Gracie Boggs said that really impressed me on Democracy Now! Was she said, you have to change yourself before you can change your attitude toward life,
mm-hmm.
before you can be an organizer.
Well, that's a great thing to end on. So thanks for calling in, Jim.
See you later.
Okay, goodbye. Okay, Gus, that's it. Okay, first of all, I want to congratulate Gus here. I forgot to mention this before the show. He's kind of a little bit of a celebrity. He got on Democracy Now! The other day. Big photo of you. Did you know that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I wasn't really...
Stephen Salida was on, actually. You know, the professor that was denied tenure here because of his personal political beliefs. Actually, a comment about the Israeli bombing of Gaza. And we're talking about the University of Illinois and Phyllis Weiss. And here they showed a bunch of protesters, I guess, when the Salida thing was going on. Here's Gus. Biggest life, front and center in the photo and stuff. It's like, oh my gosh, you know.
All right. You know, the biggest thing is that they showed all the different groups getting out there and talking about what we're trying to put forth and show this ridiculous oppressive measure that was passed down. So that's all that really matters. With
okay.
That. I don't even,
Okay. But getting back to Gracie Boggs, okay. You know, I kind of got a little distracted there right at the end. So, yeah. Basically, I mean, I wonder what brought this on, basically, her from going to working class organizing to, as you said, kind of this self-development thing?
I mean, as she talks about in one of the last books that she published in 2011.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I can't remember the name of it. My computer just died.
But
in the book, she talks about this idea that there needs to be some type of, and Jim's quote actually is what she's trying to push forward now, this idea of individual development.
So I mean, exclusively. I mean, I could see this in conjunction with organizing, you know.
Well, she's saying that, she's putting it forth as being she's taking all of the onus and the problems of oppression off the backs of capitalists by doing this. And she's pushing forward this idea of urban gardening and
it takes away from the whole structural analysis, and system, you know, of the system. Mm-hmm. And when Jim said, change yourself, I was wondering what she meant from what to what.
No, that's exactly the problem. Yeah. Is that she's pushing.
You need to change yourself before you could be an organizer. How do I need to change myself?
Well, I don't think she's saying that. I believe that she's pushing uplift ideology, that we need to start looking at ourselves and seeing what's wrong with us and why we're suffering, instead of looking at the structural problems and taking away from individual stuff. And again, this is something that happened well after the 1970s, and she actually says that in the Black Power has run its course. So it's time to, you know, go and do something else, you know. And, you know, I feel as though that she, like a lot of radicals from that time period, that she kind of got this nihilist view of revolution, and understanding that it might not be the possible way to go, but from where she ended up is leaving working class consciousness and organizing to pushing this idea of urban gardening in Detroit, you know, which we all know, if you do an individual garden plot in the city of Detroit where mass poverty and hunger is going on, it's not a very effective measure unless it's like a collective protest against Detroit. You know, mm-hmm. she, in other words, what I'm saying is the book and her work is not calling for an active protest against Detroit. It's about self-improvement and gardening to fulfill your own self-sufficiency. That's what she's pushing.
Yeah.
At the end of her life. So
totally out of context. I mean, if this was wrapped into struggle, you know, as basically one component, but the main focus still be on changing the system. Yeah, I could see it, but to go basically make that the sole focus. Yeah, that's just totally, wow.
Especially in Detroit, because Detroit is like the poster child for dysfunctional system.
Oh, it's the front lines of the class struggle. Oh,
yeah. It wasn't all the individuals that lived in Detroit who broke Detroit.
Right.
It was a few individuals that control a system.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Well, the thing I just want to put forth is that, you know, she just passed on and she did so many incredible things early in her life. You know, she was one of the first to actually translate a lot of Karl Marx's papers. You know, she worked with C.L.R. James and did a lot of great work, you know, published a lot of amazing articles and things. If you get a chance to read them, they're all online. So she did a lot of great things for revolutionary politics and radicalism. She's an amazing icon for that. But again, just like different groups of people, just like King, just like Malcolm X, just like other leaders, you know, we need to make sure that we look at how dynamic these figures are and how they shift their ideologies over time so that we understand who they fully are and not try to homogenize or generalize their lifestyles or their biography. So, you know,
yes. Yeah. And it goes into the whole basic thing of what do you want to call it? Cult of personality, you know?
Exactly. We have to periodize these people to make sure we understand exactly what they stood for.
Okay, very good. Well, you've been listening to the World Labor Hour, and I want to let everyone know that there's going to be a dinner in Springfield, Illinois, honoring Mother Jones like every year. And get more details, you can go to the Mother Jones dinner websites. You just Google it in, and I'm sure it will come up. Unless, Bob, you got some information, specific information on that? Or hey.
No, okay. Not on that.
Okay. Okay. But
I was going to talk about the fact that the 11th and the 12th just kind of commemorates Mother Jones and the whole thing there, you know?
Yes, indeed.
And there's a shrine in Illinois, it says, that deserves a pilgrimage by all labor-minded persons. It's the Union Miners Cemetery in Mount Olive, Illinois. It's the only union-owned cemetery in the country, and the fascinating story of why it came to be is amazing. It was based off of the Verdun riot, although we would probably refer to it as the Verdun massacre around here. It after some strikes and stuff in the coal mines in Illinois, a train carrying 180 African Americans from Birmingham, Alabama, came up, and the miners that were on strike had kind of set up a blockade there, and there was guards, Pinkerton guards and whatnot on the train, and there was other detectives inside a stockade that they had built around the top of the mine there. And a firefight broke out, and 10 people were killed, I guess. It says here, 4 from Mount Olive were killed in the shootout with mine guards on October 12, 1898, as the train carrying the 180 black strikebreakers recruited from Birmingham attempted to pass through the band of armed strikers. The mine guards were imported from St. Louis. They were better armed and had the advantage of the stockade. And the train's engineer was wounded, and so he returned the train to Springfield with the strikebreakers still on board. It said dead were 7 miners and 5 guards. 40 other miners and 4 guards were wounded. So that happened on October 12th, 1898. Mother Jones adopted those guys kind of as her boys, and she's buried in that cemetery in Mount Olive. They built a monument to her, and they dedicated that back on October 11th of 1930. She was 100 years old at the time.
Okay.
It cost them $16,000, a little over that. All the labor was donated, and it's like 22 feet high, made of 80 tons of pink Minnesota granite. So I got most of this information from IllinoisLaborHistory.org.
Okay.
And, as you say, the dinner's gonna be tomorrow night.
Yes.
October 11th.
Indeed. Yes, it's in Springfield, and, I'm sorry I don't have
I've got the details right.
Okay,
here.
Bill, let's hear the details.
Okay, the 30th Annual Mother Jones Dinner, hosted by Mother Jones Foundation at Aaron's Pavilion, South Wind Park. 4965 South 2nd Street in Springfield. Maybe that's the foundation, I guess.
Okay.
Okay, this will be happening October 11th, 2015, which is tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
There will be a social hour at 5 p.m., a dinner at 6 p.m., and the program is at 7 p.m. Join us for an evening of history and unionism as Mary B. McMillan, Secretary Treasurer of the North Carolina AFL-CIO, serves as our keynote speaker. Mary B. is the first female officer in the history of the North Carolina AFL-CIO.
I bet.
Our friend Bucky Hawker,
uh-huh,
will provide musical entertainment celebrating the songs and legacy of Joe Hill. Contact Al Piper at 217-522-4688. Or Terry Reed at 217-789-6495 for more information.
And what site is that, Bill, that people can go to?
This is the ilafl-cio.org.
Okay, so the Illinois AFL-CIO.
Yeah, and I want to clarify where it's happening for sure. I got a flyer. Yeah, it's at something called Aaron's Pavilion, South Wind Park.
Okay.
So Google that and look.
Okay.
And a quick quote here from Mother Jones. This was her special request to the miners of Mount Olive, Illinois. It says, "When the last call comes for me to take my final rest, will the miners see that I get a resting place in the same clay that shelters the miners who gave up their lives on the hills of Verdon, Illinois, on the morning of October 12, 1898, for their heroic sacrifice of their fellow men. They are responsible for Illinois being the best organized labor state in America. I hope it will be my consolation when I pass away to feel I sleep under the same clay with these brave boys."
Okay. So. Yeah, you know, of course, those African-American strikebreakers are brought from, you know, Birmingham, Alabama. From what I understand, they were miners, I mean, themselves, but they weren't told they were going into a strike situation. Yeah. Imagine that.
Well, the majority of them ended up not even participating because once they found out that they were going to be scabs, they said, "We're not doing this."
Yeah. Okay, you've been listening to World Labor Hour, and we're going to leave you with a little bit of Mother Jones' tribute here in song. And then after that, stay tuned for the Union Edge. And until next week, be safe, empower the people. Take care.
I was traveling through Illinois when I was invited to stop and sing at a memorial there in the little town of Mount Olive. Now, who of note in American history is buried in the cemetery in Mount Olive, Illinois? I'll give you a hint. It was a woman. It was the Union Miners Cemetery. Do you have it yet? Mary Harris Jones, Mother Jones. It's hard for the mind to encompass a life that embraced the presidencies between Andrew Jackson and Herbert Hoover. Why, when Mother Jones was a little girl, there were people still alive who remembered the Revolutionary War. And she died on the eve of the New Deal. Her millinery shop burned down in the Chicago fire, and she had heard Abraham Lincoln speak in person. Mostly, though, Mother Jones was the miner's friend. Down in Kentucky, Tennessee, West Virginia, well, the men would be organizing the underground workers, the miners. Mother Jones had already organized their wives and led them over the snow-covered game trails down into the hollows, where, armed with mops and brooms, they drove the scabs out of the coal pits. Now, Mother Jones wasn't an organizer, she was an agitator, which meant often enough she was hated as much by the organizers as by the bosses. One time, Mother Jones was out in Colorado at the great Ludlow strike. Now, that was the strike...